If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 144. I'm Chris, and with me today is...
I am Matt.
And we're going to talk Star Trek Picard. Because it is not too long, 13 days from when we're recording this podcast, that Star Trek Picard is on. And I think there's quite a bit we want to talk about. This probably won't be a super long show, but it'll be reasonable. So let's start off with, you know, we've talked about Picard in the past. We both expressed early on our reticence of it being good. So what is your impression today after seeing the New York Comic Con trailer and then the Children of Mars short trek, which relates to that trailer?
Well, as I think you kind of alluded to, I think as we have gotten trickles of information about what the show is going to be and what it's about, I think we went from, at least I did anyway, from complete anxiety to willingness to at least give it a shot.
Yeah, I'm there with you in that respect. I was not sure how they were going to pull it off. You know, then I saw, particularly with the teaser trailer, there just wasn't enough meat on that at all to make a determination on whether I would actually be interested in watching the show. Now that I've seen the San Francisco Comic-Con trailer, and now the New York Comic-Con trailer, and then the Children of Mars short trek, I think the show is starting to round out quite a bit. It's interesting, though, because evidently Patrick Stewart wants to make a political statement, which Star Trek is not unknown to have done. I mean, we look at TOS and look how far Gene Roddenberry pushed the boundaries. You know, the first interracial kiss on television, the fact that we had minority as main cast members and in the crew. You know, that was pretty fantastic. You know, you always hear the story about how Dr. Martin Luther King encouraged Nichelle Nichols to not quit the show, because she was such a role model to blacks, much less black women, you know, because of her role. and so, you know, there, Star Trek has always tackled some of these societal things that have gone on.
But, you know, there's a difference between tackling social issues and tackling Trump and Brexit.
Well, correct. I mean, the article we both looked at talks about, you know, it being a political message rather than a social issue message. Now, you could argue that some of the political message is social. I think largely, you know, a part of it is, it goes back to that whole thing. One of the things that I think that is interesting about fear is, you know, particularly when we talk about things in the sense of, like, fear-mongering, you know, there are people who definitely, they will attach themselves to people's insecurities, and they will fester them and use that to guide people to do certain things. And then I think there's a lot of people in society who make decisions based upon their fear. And so it then gets reflected back in media and movies and books and things like that. I mean, it's not uncommon for, you know, the signs of your times. Look at all the pop culture that's going on, and you can see it. And, I mean, we've talked about this in the past, too. You know, one of the things, and this is more akin to, like, the first interracial kiss on television, but look how many shows have prominent now, that being said, I think you have to have a reason for that, not just because I need a gay character to be
necessarily think you need to have a reason to have a gay character on the show. No. What I think you need is you just need to have a character that has an important role, and if
they happen to be gay,
that's a...
But that's what I'm saying. That's more akin to the interracial kiss. That, you know, it's becoming more acceptable, so, you know, within the greater society. But, you know, yeah, I mean, just like anything, a lot of these shows pander to minority groups, and you know, it's no different than having the what we always call eye candy. You know, it's eye candy. It's just another form of eye candy. You know, I have a gay character. I have a big busted blonde who never says anything, sitting over in the corner, but we call her by name. You know, it's kind of like Galaxy Quest, and Sigourney Weaver's character's role. You know, she repeated everything that the computer said. But of course, we come to find out it's important because the computer only listened to her. But, you know, that's my point. Now, when it starts getting political, like we're wanting to... And I guess this is part of the whole thing that a lot of people have had a problem with Star Trek, particularly starting in the middle of Deep Space Nine. You didn't really get it in Voyager. You didn't get it a whole lot in Enterprise, but you did get it some in Deep Space Nine. You definitely got it in the J.J. world of the Kelvin timeline movies. But this whole darkening, everything has to be dark. And, you know, all the motives of all these people have to be suspect. So you can't have heroes anymore. Or you can't have heroes that are shiny clean, you know. And that's part of the suspension of disbelief, is that things are good here because, you know, that's what I'm hoping for. Or I need a break from all the turmoil, so I need my character, I need the story to be wrapped up and tied in the shiny little bow at the end, you know. Kind of like the first season of last episode of the first season of Discovery. We had to end all storylines because we didn't know if Discovery was coming back for a second season. But, you know, and I don't mind the darkening of some of these worlds, like Batman, The Dark Knight. Particularly since they kept rebooting this. It's like Spider-Man. They keep rebooting it.
Mm-hmm.
New Spider-Man. He's a different age. All this other stuff. So they have to do something to make you want to watch it. Because why is it different? And that was the same thing with Batman. We went from Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton to, you know, which was almost an elevated farcical version of Batman. And you know, and that series of movies that included Val Kilmer as Batman. That one was very farcical. You know, it was almost like the original campy Batman television show with Adam West and Burt Ward. But now everything is the Dark Knight. So it's Star Trek, the Dark Knight. Even Discovery is Discovery, the Dark Knight. I mean, as much as I love that show, and that's what I think drew me to the Pike and Spock and number one characters from the Enterprise crew, is they weren't dark, you know. Pike is a hero. You feel like he's a hero. Like you always felt Kirk was a hero. And that's my concern right now with the show, with the Picard show, is that Picard, for the most part, was a hero. You know, he was above all of these things,
but he's always been a different kind of hero.
Yeah, he was not the action hero that a Pike and a Kirk are, and even an Archer.
Right.
He sat on the ship, and he was a diplomat. Riker was the action guy.
Right, and I think what I'd like to see this show explore is the idea that now that he's essentially at the end of his time of being influential, does he have regrets?
Yes.
And what are they? And does he think doing something different would have made
a change for the good?
That's significant.
Yeah.
Because for me, the thing that I fear after reading this article is that the reason why there are only six stars on the UFP flag in whatever year it is that Discovery Season 3 is because we've now become isolationist and we're doing FedEx it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just not where I want this whole thing to go.
No, me neither.
And if it does, I think that's outrageous.
I agree. Well, and, you know, it's kind of funny. And I don't want to get into the politics of it because it's really deep. You know, I've been following Brexit for a long time. And we almost had an exit in the United States back in the 1860s. And I don't know that both the exit nor the response to the exit was entirely legal. If you looked at it from a constitutional standpoint.
Right.
But, like, in as much as of the turmoil, and again, I think it's fear driving this, that's going on with Brexit today, at the end of the day, the reason that people voted to do Brexit was because it's going to be better for their country overall.
But to me, the thing that...
But see,
that I find particularly irritating is that someone like Patrick Stewart can then hop on this stage and pontificate about how his own people voted.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not like Donald Trump made a decision and said, like,
hey, we're doing Jeremy Corbyn, Boris Johnson, you guys are leaving the European Union. It's not like we forced this. It was a very, actually... I doubt there was very little U.S. involvement in that, you know, just because from a political standpoint, when all that was going on, well, one, it wasn't Trump, for one thing.
Right.
But two...
At least initially.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. This is not just one Brexit vote. No. It's been every Brexit vote. And we've had, like, they've had three, four?
Yeah.
I mean, how many times do you have to have a consensus... through an election before liberals finally get it in their head that this is not something that is good for the country.
Yeah. I don't want to call them liberals anymore. That's a misnomer. Why? Socialists.
Well.
Because that's exactly what it is.
I don't know Patrick Stewart well enough to call him a socialist. I know him well enough to call him a liberal.
Yeah. But again, liberal's not a good term for that.
Well, either. I mean, he could be an uber liberal. Leftist.
A leftist.
Let's just say a leftist.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, a franchise like Star Trek, that would be just like, well, I mean, as bad as the Star Wars movies have been, that might have improved them. But I mean, if they had added a whole bunch of political ideology in the Star Wars movies that some people love because that's all they've ever known. I don't know that it would. Well, one, it won't stand the test of time, and that's one of the things that you really have to think about.
And honestly, let's view this Picard series through that lens for a moment. If this truly is, because let's not forget, Patrick Stewart has been a big part of the driving force behind the development of this series.
Exactly.
If this is truly what he's wanting to do with this series,
it'll end quickly.
And it should end quickly.
Yep.
Because it won't have lasting impact.
Yeah.
Plus, once the UK does finally get out of the European Union,
again, pop culture's going to change. You know.
And it turns out it's good for the UK,
yeah,
which it should be, because I don't know how you do that. Yeah. Well, other than saying, we'll create some time anomaly, and this will now become the Stewart universe.
Yeah.
And
well, what's you know, the other thing that,
done.
That is interesting about it, one of the things Star Trek has always done well in the sense of the television show and the movies, hence the reason they created the Kelvin timeline in the first place, was they do a good job of continuity. And so if we go back before, so we have Discovery Season 3, which shows UFP flag with six stars. You know, Earth, Vulcan, Teller, Andor, a couple others. Alpha Centauri, and something else. Because it's not the Kelvin timeline, so Vulcan can still be there. 40 Eridania. I'm not a geek at all.
Not even a little bit.
But you have all the references in Enterprise and Deep Space Nine with the Section 31 episodes. And you have the, what was, they had the, in Voyager, you had the time ship where they sent, had to send 7 of 9 back to do some things. You know, they brought her into the future to go back and do, but to go back into a future point, I mean, it's convoluted. And so obviously the Federation is bigger than six stars at some point in the future.
But I'm not even certain that we can call that because we've also had All Good Things.
Yeah.
You know, anytime they take us forward, we've come to learn that those are always potential futures that get manipulated. So we may not ever see that as a future either. So I mean, it's that whole time bureau.
Well, what does it matter? It means that at some other future, there's millions of planets in the Federation of planets. Again.
It's
kind of interesting. Maybe
the first season will be like that, and people will either react well to it,
and you know, and that being said, it could reflect what he feels the future looks like today, but he didn't write the episode, so maybe the writing is so good it tells a good story.
Well, and that's
and there and are
that's,
some,
there's a good possibility of that happening, yeah. But here's the problem that I have. Then you cannot call that Star Trek.
No, well, I'm having a hard time calling it Star Trek for the fact that it doesn't revolve around the United Federation of Planets and Starfleet. You know.
I'm not opposed to.
This is like Voyager, except Voyager was never a Starfleet ship. I mean, it could be set in the Star Trek universe. It could be good.
This goes back to the whole idea of having like a Klingon show.
Yeah.
I've always thought that would be okay.
Yeah.
You could still call that Star Trek, I think.
Yeah.
But I think that's too radical a departure from what Gene Roddenberry had wanted the show to be.
Correct.
And that's not to say that Gene's vision for it is the... it's the blueprint of what's worked.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's the question, too, is although Patrick Stewart has had a lot of involvement in it, you know, Gene Jr., he's the one who controls that IP for CBS, you know, and it'll be interesting to see what his involvement has been, because he's certainly been involved. You can tell he's had his fingers in, definitely in Discovery, you know, and stuff, and you know, and I know the Star Wars fans kind of will
setting, you know, any Star Wars is better than no Star Wars. And to some degree, any Trek is better than no Trek. Unless it really isn't Trek. And I've, you know, the one thing that I'm interested in is the fact that, you know, I've been a role-playing gamer for, I don't know, since I was 10 or 11 years old playing. Started with D&D, but I've always gravitated towards science fiction games, particularly the Star Trek ones. And Matt and I, 20-some-odd years ago, gamed together, and we do till this day. And, you know, I've always been curious, like, in the Fastest Star Trek RPG game, one of my favorite supplemental books was the where you could create a independent traitor character, and, you know, and that's kind of the story that they're in some respects are kind of telling, but it's kind of funny because
that would be like a Harry Mudd
focused series.
And even that I think would be
this is
interesting.
More and you know, and maybe we look at it. You have to look at it. This is kind of like a Maquis focus series.
But here's my problem with that. Here you're taking a guy of Picard's stature, and you're basically saying at the end of his career, he's saying, "Screw it. It was all for nothing, and I should never have done it."
Yeah.
If that's what his take is, I can't go there.
Yeah. It's not believable in that case.
I can't go there.
Yeah.
You don't do all the... You don't come back from being Locutus and all of that. And then just turn around and turn your back on all of it.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Now, I mean, it could surprise us. And, you know, one of the things that I'm hoping is that, you know, as they introduce us and develop these new characters that are either former, some of them are former Starfleet, some are former Romulans, and other things that we find out some of these people are not who they appear to be. The subterfuge angle, I don't mind in this case. Particularly if we're going to go to Dark Trek, you know, it's a dark time for the Federation. I think this might be the Section 31 show.
Well, there's still an awful lot we don't know.
Yeah.
We were talking after watching the trailers and the Children of Mars. We don't know who this race is
that attacks
them and what their motivations are and how they tie into what's going on with the Borg in this show.
And we still don't know. You know, we know from the comic books prior to. So, and this is one of the weird things too. So, the events that take place before this movie are technically what fires off the Kelvin tunnel.
Right. And which is what we've always been told, which is why this Mars attack thing has not made sense to me yet, and it still doesn't.
Yeah. And we know that through the comic books that were released from CBS and Paramount prior to the 2009 Star Trek movie that... that the destruction of Romulus is what caused the what is the name of the ship, the Narada, to go through that wormhole and then end up in, you know, creating the Kelvin timeline, because he followed Spock, who had taken the jellyfish starship and all this other stuff. So that being said, you know, I'm hoping they're not doing this. It's too convoluted to have too many of these like alternate timelines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that being said, you know, the events and the attack that happens in the Children of Mars, and that's also in the New York Comic Con trailer, the newer trailer. That attack is after the destruction But it's a result of the destruction of Romulus for some reason. You know, and we don't have enough to make it. I think it can be entertaining, but I don't think you're going to do a multi-season show and keep people's interest having another, having this dark world, almost.
Well, this goes back
dystopian
to
dystopian Federation.
This goes back to Discovery season
one. Yeah, you can only have a war go on for so long. Enterprise season two.
Yes.
I mean, 22 episodes, and then the first episode of season three, and you're like, oh my god, I hope this ends because it was just too long, and even though I know I watched them.
But
I have blocked out most of the war with the Founders in Deep Space Nine.
For me, though, the thing is you can have a show that's devoted to war.
Yep, Battlestar Galactica is a good example.
Which is exactly what I was gonna say. You can do a Star Trek show that's devoted to a war.
Yeah.
What you can't do is what they've done.
Yeah. And I do have to say this about Battlestar Galactica. In the middle of all of that,
I don't even remember what the middle season would have been,
they started suffering fatigue.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, people were like, man, this is the same thing week after week, and that's what happened in season two of Enterprise. And that's what happened in the Dominion War on Deep Space Nine. There's just a lot of fatigue going on because it didn't seem like the story is moving along far enough. You know, there weren't enough.
Well, and there were too many moving parts,
yeah,
too. You know what I mean? When you have the big baddie is a collection of six or seven races, and they each have their own motivations and their own politics,
yeah,
and all of that.
Yeah.
It then becomes about that.
Exactly.
And that's what's not selling. BSG was about humanity's survival.
True.
This is why I think the whole Axanar thing
would have been
what Discovery was billed as. That whole first season should have been and would have been okay.
Yeah.
It would have done better than what we got.
The beginning of the first season. I will say this. I think at the end of the first season, by the midpoint, pretty much everything after the Harry Mudd episode, because the Harry Mudd episode was excellent, it then focused on Lorca and Giorgio and that the whole Terran Empire and that piece. And that was interesting. Because, again, we weren't focusing on the war with the Klingons that, was going on.
But the problem with that was it became the focus of what the show was. It wasn't the diversion that it was needed.
Yeah.
It became...
No, the Harry Mudd episode was the diversion.
Right.
And basically what it was...
It really a pivot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because once we got into the whole Mirror Universe stuff, that whole show just changed. The whole Klingon thing became less important.
Yeah.
And then it became about what's going on in the Mirror Universe. And even that has a certain level of appeal.
Yes.
You can do a show that's all about that. But don't sell me a show that's about something else,
yeah,
and then get into it and recognize... I mean, this goes back to our whole bit about the whole chaos around Discovery's first season anyway.
Yes.
We did not expect this show to do well it didn't do well. It did well enough to get a second season to save it. But it was total chaos. And there were way too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean,
to give you a coherent start to a series.
Look how many people changed. But by the time second season started production, the people at the top were all new. You know, Brian Fuller had pretty much quit by the filming of the third episode of season one. And so then the couple, I can't remember their name, took over.
Yeah.
You know, you know, so, yeah, I agree. I mean, could have Discovery season one been a lot better? Absolutely. I mean, by far.
Well, I think it could have been better from the perspective of some level of continuity within itself.
Well, and that's my fear about. So my biggest complaint about season one of Discovery, because season two was excellent. I mean,
it was
by far. I mean, the way they introduced some of the new characters like Jet Reno and Captain Pike and even Spock, because my worry on season two of Discovery was that, oh, we're bringing Spock in, and he's younger Spock than what we know. You know, how are they, you know, how is this guy going to be able to...
And it's not like we haven't explored young Spock before.
No, because we had it in the cartoon.
Right. Well, I mean, I just, this has all been stuff we've...
Yeah. You know, but Ethan Peck did an amazing job, and the writing was good. And one of the things that I thought was good about it, too, is they were cautious in their use of Spock. You know, they didn't really bring him in until, like, the last three or four episodes where he was a main character. Before that, you know, in the beginning of the season, Spock was a concept. He was somebody who was out there. They didn't know what was going on, but he had disappeared. And then they catch Spock, and he's not totally coherent. You know, and as time goes on, they integrate him in. But Pike...
Now, the thing about Spock's nutty...
Yeah.
...is... I think it's a redo. Because we've seen Spock stage a nutty how many times?
Yeah.
In the course of the original series, and... I mean, honestly, I think his whole bit with the motion picture is another episode of him staging a nutty. It's been done.
Yeah.
Is my thing. I don't...
Well, it was definitely that, him not, as you say, being, you know, doing a nutty or the incoherent character, that was definitely a plot device to...
Right.
To move the story along. You know, and explain in a continuity fashion, you know, how we get from A to B. But, you know, the way they introduced the characters, the way they introduced Pike. Now, the advantage of Pike is and we've talked about this before, is what background did they have to create? He got, essentially, Anson Mount got to create Pike, the real Pike. Because... The only real so Jeffrey Hunter, you know, they didn't ever air the original pilot. So when people first saw it, the only thing they ever knew about Pike was the flashbacks where they were using film from the original pilot in the episode, you know, where they're going back to drop Pike off at Talos 4. And, so, but there wasn't much there. I mean, there's a lot of character development that could be have been done, that would have been done had Jeffrey Hunter remained in the role, and, you know, and they aired the original pilot. So, and then you get the alternate Admiral Pike, you know, Captain Pike, then Admiral Pike in the first two Kelvin timeline movies, and you know, he basically created a Pike was not the same Pike that we have on the in TOS at that point, from the beginning. You know, so that Pike, and then they kill him off. So and he didn't have that much role to play and develop as a character in the Kelvin movies. So Ansem Knott got to create Pike. I mean, he had some boundaries he had to fit within, but he largely got to create Pike. And the same thing is for Rebecca Romijn and her portrayal of Number One. Yes, there's some boundaries because Majel Barrett was the first Number One in that original pilot and everything, but at the end of the day, you know, she's allowed to take the rest of that on and create that character. So and so, although they're familiar characters, if you're a real Trek fan, in essence, they're almost like new characters. You know, and the thing that is a little bit disconcerting about Discovery, in some respects, I really like it. In some respects, I don't. Is that every season is like a new Star Trek.
Yeah. I mean, it really is.
You know?
Which, to me, I think is a struggle. Because we have these same characters just dropped in somewhere new.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard to get settled. And that's something that I think Star Trek needs to do. It needs to settle.
Yeah.
I mean, you have some... Next Gen didn't really settle until Season 3.
Yeah.
You could make the argument TOS never settled. You could actually make the argument that it got worse, I suppose.
Well, I think a large part of TOS's issue is, one, the television industry back then when it was made, and the fact that there were a lot of continuity errors, not because the show was, you know, what Gene was producing was had continuity errors, but because they would air the episodes out of order of when they were produced. So
well,
in consequence, I think one of the things that happens is with TOS that a lot of shows ended up taking on because it was still successful to a large degree was that an episode was an entire story arc.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't when we brought in TNG, that's the model they started with because Gene was still running the show at the time. But when Season 3 kind of came in and we, you know, everybody feels that it hit its stride, that's when they had multiple story arcs going on. You had an episodic story arc. You might even have a couple. You know,
typically an A and B story.
Yeah. And then you had a larger story arc for the season. You know, and it wasn't always apparent that every episode fit in that larger story arc until you saw all of them and watched them multiple times, frankly. And then, you know, then you also had the multi-episodic story arcs like, you know, Locutus and Borg, you know, The Best of Both Worlds 1 and 2.
Although I think in TNG, a lot of that was still by accident. That didn't really become a thing
until
DS9.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I agree with you. I think it's something that developed over time, partly by accident. You know, I think part of it was they were manipulating things so that people were looking at what is perceived as successful and what isn't, and so they were manipulating how it was evolving over time. Because definitely by Season 7, they were really operating in that A and B. They really had three. You had an A, B, and C story arc thing going on by the end. You had the main story arc, which would be the A story arc for the episode, you know, with that the main conflict. And then you would have B and C, which were two smaller conflicts that would get resolved sometimes within, you know, within like a 10 or 15 minute period in the show with other characters, you know, the Below Decks crew.
Mainly because I think you're talking about a show that has an ensemble cast, and you have to try and get
all of them doing something. Yes.
Right.
And I think that's what drove that. And then you had Story Arc D, which was more of a seasonal story arc.
Right.
You know.
And some of those, I think they started to do them as like two-parters and three-parters, and then that became
seasonal.
Let's do the seasonal thing.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah, I mean, by the time Deep Space Nine kind of hit its stride,
you know, which was really the beginning of the introduction of the Dominion, which was the beginning of the Dominion War, that's when it became that you had seasonal story arcs, because they were still doing the same thing. You had A, B, and C per episode. Then you had D, which was a seasonal story arc. And then you had E, which was a multiple seasonal story arc.
Right.
And I, you know, that also became how Voyager worked, too. Because Voyager had an F story arc.
But this,
from the beginning to the end of the whole series.
Which is what I am struggling with Discovery.
Yeah.
About.
Yeah, there's no F story arc.
There's no... There's no home in Discovery.
Yeah.
I mean, even the ship can't be a home because, quite frankly, when did we actually see Discovery? Yeah, I mean, it was 4 or 5 episodes in.
It was in the second episode, but yeah.
It felt like 4 or 5 episodes in.
Well, Discovery Season 1, that if I have to say my biggest complaint, and I know that they were trying to introduce all these new characters and give history and background on Michael Burnham and all these people, but the first episode almost made me not want to watch the second episode. If they had built it as a two-parter, I wouldn't have watched the second episode. You know what I mean? That initial pilot,
I got to
while end, interesting,
I got to the end of the first episode, and I was like, I don't even want to watch. I don't care to see how this gets resolved. I just don't. Had they built it totally as a two-parter, and they did.
There
has to be a hook, something that makes me really want to watch it, and I just didn't. I got to the end, I was like, okay, who cares?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, and they did correct this through the first season, and they reinforced it heavily in the second season, but with the particularly the way they handled the first episode, I had no emotional involvement or attachment to any of the characters, and that's your hook. That's
my point. To this day, I still don't understand why Georgiou is even on this show.
Yeah,
there's no point to her.
Well, it's because CBS paid a lot of money for her to be on the show, and so they're exercising their rights to use the contract.
but you're right. If her character wasn't there, it really wouldn't impact anything. And you know, and I have to say this, of the actual Discovery cast, I'm not really that attached to any of them that I,
and the question
and
that
so
I
the second season of Discovery, I'm attached. I mean, from the first episode, I'm attached to Pike and Spock and Number One and Jet Reno, and I mean, I'm attached to those characters, and luckily going into season 3, Jet Reno is with them, so I'm attached to that character at least. Hopefully they won't kill her off, because you know that's the other trope now in all movies and television shows, is we're going to kill off beloved characters. You know, name a show. I mean, I'm going to digress here a minute, but it's still a CBS show. I watch all the NCIS's, and my favorite has always been NCIS New Orleans. One, I still like Archer. I mean, Scott Bakula. I mean, Pride. But my real favorite character of that show was always
LaSalle.
Chris LaSalle. And what do? Now, I know why they kill characters off in shows. I mean, you grow up, you understand it. These actors want to do other things, what they want to do is not necessarily compatible with being on a television show as a major character any longer. But they killed him off. Now, if it were Star Trek, I wouldn't care, because in Star Trek, even if you're dead, you're not dead. Same thing with Star Wars. Even if you're not dead, you can always become come back as a Force ghost. Even if you're not a Jedi. We've learned that because of Rise of Skywalker.
Well, I mean, I think there's ways to bring him back.
Yeah.
You can do flashbacks. Flashback, and all that, exactly. But, essentially a time travel story in a real world kind of show. But I mean,
Discovery Season 1, the character I was most attached to was Lorca.
Yeah.
I loved Lorca. Even when you find out he's bad, you know, his motivations are completely bad, I'm still like, I really like this guy, you know. We could party.
For me, the thing about him was, if you're going to fight a war... He's the kind of guy
that you need. Yeah.
You know,
he was the warrior amongst a bunch of scientists and research. And what I loved about how, and I don't know if
now he pushed some ethical bounds. Yeah, that you can't respect.
But again, that's what you want. You wanted to push those boundaries, make you think about, well, should he really be doing this or shouldn't he not?
Right.
You know, do the ends justify the means? That's good storytelling. But the thing is...
It is even good Star Trek.
It is good Star Trek. And the thing that I loved about Lorca prior to us finding out that he was from the mirror universe...
Which bugs me, by the way.
Yeah. Well, my curiosity about that is... So I think they definitely planned the Harry Mudd episode because they wanted to bring that beloved character back in. And Rainn Wilson does a great job. And the other reason I believe they brought that episode was originally written was because they did a short trek later to continue that story.
Right.
I'm not totally certain that... Well, we know that they wrote the last episode right as they were getting ready to film. Because everything was tied up in a little bow. Because they wanted to make sure that there was continuity and if you know, if the show ended, at least it ends and there's resolution to all these storylines. Because they did. They resolved every freaking storyline. But I am not sure that after they had filmed and started airing the first part of the season and they were going, oh my God, we've got to change something because people aren't resonating with this war story, that they didn't change Lorca's character to become that.
Plus, I think another part of it is...
Again, they wanted to bring...
I didn't care for him.
They were looking for a way to bring Georgiou back so that they could utilize the contract that they had for... Because it seems to me that the second season of Discovery had a lot more thought put into it than the first. That might be why it's taken so long for Picard... to have gotten produced, and then also the third season of Discovery, because they were being much more thoughtful about the stories and what they wanted to tell.
This is why I keep going back to that whole... I mean, we've been hearing about how Discovery was coming for...
Ever.
And it never felt like there was any cohesive... thought put behind it at all. Start with the fact that this show has had more captains than any other show, period.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, and I think as much, you know, and like I said, you know, one of the things that has to hook you in is you have to become attached to the character. Not you don't have to be completely in love with all of them, but you have to have one that you are attached to.
But you know what, though? Typically, you have to like the star
Correct.
Of the show.
And I don't like Burnham.
I don't care for her.
I don't care. Well, like I said, the characters who intrigue me, well, they killed one of them off. The human who was turned into an android because of the shuttle accident.
Oh, yeah.
Lieutenant Commander. Again,
I didn't remember her name.
Well, they only Arian. they only had her for, you know, actually as a real character for a couple episodes. And then the other three bridge crew members, they actually gave names to.
But it's just like they're throwing things at you, and they want something to stick. And it's just like that. No other Star Trek show has ever done that.
No.
I mean, they've had it where they've had, like, Kes. Clearly was not working.
Absolutely.
The actress wasn't working. The character wasn't working. They just needed to find a way to get her off the show and bring in someone who actually could work on this show.
Yeah.
This was just like they decided that CBS All Access was going to launch on a particular date, and they had to have a show, and they didn't care what it was. They just had to have a show on that had the Star Trek name on it.
Yeah.
And this is what we
got. I agree. I think that's why there was a lot of chaos with the producers and writers and everybody that first season of Discovery, because the I think Brian Fuller they gave Brian Fuller too much control, and he just wasn't coming up with anything that was working. And I think they went into production.
But he left by like episode three.
That's what I'm saying.
So I mean,
they went into production, and they realized that, man, this is okay, but it's not great.
Well, again, start with the fact that the premiere episode, which they aired on network television as a way to get you to shell out money to even watch the back half of it, was boring. And the bulk of the characters didn't even make it to the end of the season.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, the ship didn't make it to the end of the season, let alone, you know.
The ship they started with, the ship was blown to crap.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Start with the fact that it's called Discovery, and you didn't even get Discovery until it...
Second episode.
But it was like at the end of it, right?
Yes, it was. It was barely...
So really, you don't get Discovery until episode three.
Yeah.
How many episodes were in the whole season?
10 or 12.
I was going to say about a dozen.
Yeah.
You have spent a sixth of the season without even being on the ship the show is named after.
Yeah.
And so they developed characters for the Shenzhou that didn't make it to Discovery. And just way too many characters that were just throwaways. And none of them really... I don't really even care for Saru.
I don't care for Saru either. So,
if you can hear my iPad, I'm looking up... those are the short tracks.
So season one had 15 episodes. So there's 15 hours in
season two at 14,
which is about right,
because you add an extra hour for the two-parter,
right? But yeah, you know, but you know, like I said, I think there was change made about halfway through, and they used the Harry Mudd episode as a pivot,
but then the thing is none of it worked. I mean, none of it worked.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think that, and this is telling too, because I think so. You Brian Fuller was let go after the third. I think he was let go. They said he left, but you know how that works. But Inertia produced another couple of episodes before they hit the Harry Mudd episode. That was the pivot. Because, so, during that time that those other episodes were being produced, the writers went back to the writers' room. Because if I remember right, in reading that when Brian Fuller started production of Discovery, they only had three or four scripts complete.
Right.
So they went back to the writer's room and told the writer, you know, under the direction of new people, said, we got to come up with something that's better. Because they were already airing the first episode at that point, you know. And I'm sure they did screen testing and, you know.
But this is where I come back and say, that whole show has been nothing but, we had established a date in which we were going to launch CBS All Access. And this show is the anchor.
Yes.
And I don't think they had any idea of what that meant or what to deliver.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, the other thing, too, is you have to really think about.
And this goes back, I think, to the failure of CBS/Paramount to put Jonathan Frakes in charge of it.
Correct. Well,
had they done that, so, yeah. I think
it'd have been much more cohesive.
Yeah.
And look at his involvement in the second season and how good the second season was. I mean, that's a good point.
I mean, I've even heard him now say that he was offered the director's chair for Nemesis and he turned it down, and now he has huge regrets.
Yeah.
That he should have taken it.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why they didn't give it to him to run with.
Yeah.
Because he said no to Nemesis.
That's great. That's a good point. You know, I think we beat this to death. I'm hoping Picard will be good and it won't be too political, or at least if it is a political story, the sad part is even if it's a political, well, I won't say the sad part, the reality of it is even if it's a political story, it's only political from the perception of whoever made it political. It's not reality.
But that's just it. Patrick Stewart has made it political.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that I think
infuriating. Yeah. The other thing you got to think about this show, and this is why I brought up the fact that the trope of right now is to kill off beloved characters, is look how old Patrick Stewart is. I mean, watching the New York Comic-Con, it would not be believable that he would have been an admiral in Starfleet anyway. You know, in active duty. Retired? Yes. Active duty? No. I mean, that was always part of the problem with J.J. Trek was the fact that, you know, you have 18-year-olds as captains of the Federation flagship and you know, and 35, 40-year-olds as fleet admirals, you know, which is not really the case in the real world. They do make those, you know, general officers retire at some point for a very good reason. And, you know, the question is how many seasons can Patrick Stewart believably do the show before they need to, you know, have Jean-Luc Picard die of old age?
And when he does, I hope it's like on Viridian 3.
Yeah.
Where he gets the kind of death that they gave Kirk.
Yeah.
That's really basically an insult. I mean, I hate to be
that way, yeah. No,
but I think that's what's fitting at this point.
Yep. So, well, we want to hear from you, our listeners, so please send us some text, video, audio mail at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.